Thank you, Lord. We bless you and praise you and ask that you be with us as we study. Amen. So this portion is a double portion. By the way, next week is as well. Tazria is when she gives birth, and Metsora is the portion that involves things said about the diseased person. It's often translated leprosy, but as we've mentioned on other occasions, the disease is not leprosy, not Hansen's disease. It's something else, and frankly, I'm not sure that anybody really knows what it is. But the Rebbe, in his essay, refers to this as real talk. This shall be the law of the Metsora, the diseased person, on the day of his purification. He shall be brought to the Kohen, and of course the Kohen is the priest. The affliction of Tzara'at, the disease that we sometimes refer to as leprosy, whose laws are detailed in the 13th and 14th chapters of Leviticus, was an entirely spiritual phenomenon. There was no natural disease. Indeed, this leprosy, and you can see that the word is in quotes, also afflicted homes and garments, but a symptom of moral degradation. Particularly the tzara'at, the afflicted person, or metzora, was one whose actions had spawned strife and divisiveness within the community by speaking negatively of others. The Metzora's punishment, measure for measure, was a supranatural, a spiritual leprosy that marked him as an outcast. The Metzora was banished to the life of solitude until such time as their repentance cured them of their leprosy and they were readmitted into society. The spiritual nature of this disease is evidenced by the fact that both the onset and the termination of the state of Tzara'at were affected by the proclamation of a Kohen, of the priest. This is one of the unusual aspects of this instruction. If suspect markings appeared on a garment, a home, or a person, they were examined by an expert, usually, but not necessarily, a Kohen, someone proficient in the complex laws and procedures that identified Tzara'at. But even after a diagnosis of Tzara'at had been made, the state of ritual impurity that pertains to the afflicted person or object did not take effect until a Kohen pronounced it impure. Nor was the impurity of a Tzara'at affected retroactively. Until the Kohen uttered the word impure, the state of Tzara'at did not commence. Thus the Torah advises to empty a Tzara'at suspect home of all of its contents before the Kohen comes to see the plague, lest everything in the house be contaminated when the Kohen pronounced it impure. This is kind of an interesting instruction here that if someone suspected that they had a skin disease that would ultimately require that a Kohen pronounce them unclean, they would empty their house of all of its possessions, right? So that when the Kohen pronounced the Metsora unclean, nothing in the house would be affected by it, right? Because the possessions would have already been removed and the pronouncement wasn't retroactive. So it began the moment the Kohen pronounced that individual unclean. By the same token, since it was the Kohen's word that affected the state of Tzara'at, the removal of this state, even after all physical signs of Tzara'at had departed, was likewise achieved only by the Kohen's decision that the Metsora had been cured of his impurity. Why the Kohen? The Kohen's role as a condemner, an ostracizer, is all the more puzzling because it appears to contradict everything that the Kohen represents. The Kohen is commanded by God to bless his people with love. Our sages describe a disciple of Aaron, the first Kohen, as one who loves peace, pursues peace, loves God's creatures, and brings them close to Torah. But it is precisely because the Kohanim are a paradigm of loving kindness that the Torah entrusts to the Kohen, and only to the Kohen, the task of condemning the Metzorah. So it's interesting that the task does not fall to a physician, to a doctor, right, who you would expect would also be familiar with the evidence or with the symptoms of leprosy, right, of tzara'at. But it's not a physician who declares them unclean. It's a Kohen. There is nothing more hateful to God than division between his children. The reason the Metzorah must be ostracized is that they themselves are a source of divisiveness. Nevertheless, the Torah is loath to separate the Metzorah from the community. It is not enough that the technical experts have deemed a person a Metzorah. It is only when the Kohen, whose very nature is repulsed by the prospect of banishing a member of the community, is convinced that an individual exhibits all the signs of tzara'at, that the Metzorah is separated from their people. There is another lesson here as well. It is not the symptoms of tzara'at that render the Metzorah ritually impure, but the Kohen's declaration of the Metzorah's impurity. In other words, no matter how terrible a person's deeds may be, no matter how corrupt the person is in body and soul, to speak ill of them is more terrible still. The Kohen saying that a person is impure affects their spiritual state more profoundly than the fact of their impurity. This explains a rather puzzling statement in the Talmud. Speaking ill of another ills three people: the speaker, the listener, and the one of whom they speak. The speaker obviously commits a grave sin by deriding their fellow. The listener, too, is a partner to this evil. But why is the one who is spoken of penalized by their deed? Is their negative state worsened by the fact that it is spoken of? Indeed, such is the case. And what the Rebbe goes on to say here is certainly worthy of consideration. It's a Kabbalistic idea, but it's something to be considered. Indeed, such is the case. A person may possess an evil trait or tendency, but their quintessential goodness, intrinsic to every soul, strives to control it, to conquer it, and ultimately eradicate its negative expressions and redirect it as a positive force. But when this evil is spoken of, it is made that much more manifest and real. By definition, a person's trait or deed, as evil to themselves and to others, the evil speakers are, in effect, solidifying it as such. With their words, they grant substance and reality to its negative form. So this is an interesting concept that when we speak negatively of each other or negatively of things generally, then our words grant substance and reality to its negative forms. But of course, the opposite would be true too. When we praise God, when we thank God, when we bless God, when we speak of the good qualities that we recognize in others, that has a positive benefit in the lives of those others as well. So the sages teach that the measure of reward is greater than the measure of punishment. A negative force, when applied positively, is far more powerful. If speaking negatively of others, the effect of accentuating and actualizing the potential bad in them, how much more so does praising and verbally reinforcing a fellow's positive potential contribute towards its actualization. Speaking well of others actually makes it so. An interesting idea. You may have heard this expression, think good and it will be good, right? That's the kind of idea behind this. But what's probably more compelling than statements like that is to recognize how powerful our words in the lives of others actually are. You've probably heard that expression, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. But the fact of the matter is that words can be far more hurtful than any sticks and stones, right? The fact is that words, our words, are very powerful. When critical, when complaining, you know, those words have a negative impact, probably not only in our lives, but in the lives of whoever it is that they are said to, right? But good words have the opposite effect, right? Words that build up, words that encourage, they have a positive effect in the lives of others too, and we should not trivialize the impact that words can have. And of course, there are many passages that address this, particularly in the Gospels. This isn't in the notes, but Yeshua says it, Paul says it, others say it too. The fact that words reflect what's in the heart, right? So words have, you know, they're a way of identifying in some cases, not always, but they're a way of identifying, you know, what's actually in a person's heart. At any rate, we're going to look at some of the statements the Rebbe makes, and we'll talk about a few of the details. Particularly, the tzara'at afflicted person, or metzora, was one whose actions had spawned strife and divisiveness within the community by speaking negatively of others. This is known, of course, as Lashon Hara, something that we've talked about before, but I wanted to include this note. Lashon Hara, translated literally as evil speech, refers to a variety of various types of language prohibited by Jewish law. Colloquially, the term is usually to refer to all manner of prohibited speech, whether true or not, and is sometimes translated as malicious gossip. But technically, Lashon Hara refers only to true speech that is damaging to the subject, right? So, Lashon Hara, hey Mark, good to see you. We're just at number one of our notes. But Lashon Hara is actually not speaking falsely of others. It's actually speaking truthfully of others. But speaking truthfully of others to people who have no business receiving the information, right? That's one of the key aspects of Lashon Hara, has to do with who whatever information is shared with, right? Obviously, sometimes when things happen, we have to share or talk to someone about what happened, right? But it's important to talk to the appropriate person, the person who can do something about it, or, you know, the person who might be affected by the behavior of that other person, right? I mean, there are occasions when even something truthful has to be shared with others, but it is something that should be done cautiously. At any rate, there are three primary categories of problematic speech in Judaism. The most general is rechilut, or gossip. Rechilut isn't necessarily negative. Maimonides describes gossip as simply going around telling people what other people have said or done, right? And, of course, sharing with others that have no need or right to know whatever it is that is being said. Negative speech that is false is called in Hebrew motzi shem ra, literally gives a bad name, or more commonly slander or defamation. And finally, there is lashon hara, which technically refers to speech that causes harm, like saying someone is a bad driver or broke the law. The statement might be true, but speaking it will hurt the person about whom it is said. Maimonides described it as a statement that, if spread from one person to another, would damage someone's body or their property, or even annoy or frighten them, right? Although Lashon Hara technically refers only to true speech that is harmful and not malicious lies, that's motzi shem ra, or harmless gossip, that's rechilut, in practice, it has colloquially come to encompass all three. There are several passages, of course, that deal with false speech. One is from Exodus 23, where we are specifically instructed, do not spread false reports. Do not help a guilty person by being a malicious witness. From Leviticus 19, do not go about spreading slander among your people. Do not do anything that endangers your neighbor's life. I am the Lord. From Psalm 34, whoever of you loves life and desires to see many good days, keep your tongue from evil. Lashoncha mara, right? Lashoncha, your tongue, your speech from evil, and keep your lips from telling lies. The word tongue means speech or language, as in Acts and the letters of Paul. The gift of tongues is a gift that enables someone to speak in a language they did not learn naturally, not to simply make babbling sounds. A passage in Acts 2, there's actually a few passages that address this, but it connects to this concept or the idea of the tongue, even though it's translated that way, it obviously refers to speech, right? It refers to speech. When someone speaks, they are communicating in a language, with the possible exception of an infant, right, who makes babbling sounds. But it's interesting because as adults, we attempt to interpret what those babbling sounds are, right? And we may say to a loved one, a spouse, see, he just said dada, or he just said mama, or he or she just said this, right? And, of course, It's difficult to know if that's what the infant actually meant. That's what it sounded like to us. But the point is, it's language. And the infant is trying as hard as it can to mimic human language, to mimic whatever language their parents or their loved ones speak, right? It, of course, surfaces in Acts chapter 2. Now, there were staying in Jerusalem God-fearing Jews from every nation under heaven. When they heard this sound, the sound of the mighty rushing wind, a crowd came together in bewilderment because each one heard their own language being spoken. Utterly amazed, they asked, "Aren't these all who are speaking Galileans? Then how is it that each of us hears them in our native language?" And of course, some translations say native tongue, right? Or our own language, but that's what a tongue is. It's a language. In 1 Corinthians 13, Paul says, if I speak in the tongues, here's an example of what I am talking about, that is the languages of men or of angels, because angels speak a language too, but do not have love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. All languages have nouns, verbs, pronouns, adverbs, adjectives, and syntax. Syntax is the arrangement of words and phrases in a specific order. In English, for example, the noun precedes the verb. In Hebrew, the verb precedes the noun. It's one of the characteristics of English. It's one of the characteristics of Hebrew, like we were talking about earlier with Lashon Hara. See, Lashon Hara is evil speech, but if you were going to translate it literally, you would say speech evil, right? Because the Lashon comes first. Ra is the word for evil. That modifies it, but that's syntax. Languages have syntax. All languages have syntax. Moving forward, though, I didn't want to get bogged down on that, but, you know, it kind of comes up in the context of the subject. In Psalm 101, whoever slanders their neighbor in secret, I will put to silence. And whoever has haughty eyes and a proud heart, I will not tolerate. A perverse friend in Proverbs 16 stirs up conflict, and a gossip, an individual who gossips, slanders or separates close friends. From the Talmud, Rabbi Samuel ben Nachmani said in the name of Rabbi Jonathan, because of seven things, the plague of leprosy, or tzara'at, is incurred. These are slander, the shedding of blood, vain oaths, incest, arrogance, robbery, and envy. If you were to put these conditions or these words in order, would you start out with slander and then add the shedding of blood? And of course, in Hebrew, because it's Hebrew, we recognize that the most prominent of these sins is mentioned first, and the least prominent is mentioned last. That's just the way Hebrew works, right? So, by definition, it means that slander is more grievous than the shedding of blood, which we, of course, would say the opposite. You know, we would say shedding blood is a lot more harmful than slander, right? But that isn't the Bible's opinion of it. Slander is worse. At any rate, moving on to Ephesians 4, get rid of all bitterness, rage and anger, brawling, notice, and slander, along with every form of malice. And it's interesting because Paul does the same thing in the order here. Get rid of all bitterness, rage, anger, brawling. And what's remarkable is that if you think about it, they all lead to slander, right? They're the preconditions for slander. At any rate, in 1 Peter, therefore rid yourselves of all malice and all deceit, hypocrisy, envy, and again, slander of every kind. But it seems as if in those two letters, Paul and Peter are emphasizing the things that lead to slander. In James 4, brothers and sisters, do not slander one another. Anyone who speaks against a brother or sister or judges them speaks against the law and judges it. And by the way, what difference does that make if Yeshua put an end to the Torah and it is no longer relevant in our lives? Right? I mean, what difference does it make if someone speaks against the Torah and judges it? I've heard many people speak against the Torah and judges it, right? I mean, I've had people say, oh, that the Torah is such a yoke of bondage, no one can keep it. You know, it's just impossible to observe, right? So how can anyone expect to be saved by observing the Torah, right? But, of course, we don't expect to be saved by observing the Torah. The Torah has nothing to do with salvation, but it is something that the Lord has called us to walk in, right? And that's true for Jews and Gentiles. The same instructions may not apply to both, but some of the instructions in the Torah apply to all of us, right? At any rate, when you judge the law, you are not keeping it. And again, why would that be a big deal if no one imagined that keeping the Torah was necessary, right? But sitting in judgment on it. Moving on to number two, the Matzora's punishment, measure for measure, was a beyond natural leprosy that marked him as an outcast. We've talked about this idea before, midah keneged midah, measure for measure, typically understood in the sense of a punishment that fits the crime. And that's one of the things that we see that the Bible emphasizes, that, you know, that when a punishment is given for a particular crime, the punishment can't exceed the crime, right? It has to be measured. In a way that, you know, serves a just conclusion or a just restoration or reconciliation in the process. In Exodus 14, then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea so that the waters may flow back over the Egyptians and their chariots and their horsemen. Right? In the Hebrew, Yashavu Hamayim, and the water will go back. The Egyptians attempted to destroy the Jewish people by casting their newborns into the water of the Nile. But ultimately, the water was to go back by virtue of the principle of measure for measure. This from the Midrash Mechilta. As King David puts it, he digs a pit, digs it deep, only to fall into his own trap. Because the Egyptian army pursued the people of Israel into the Red Sea, imagining that the dryness would sustain them as well as God's people, right? They learned the principle of midah keneged midah, measure for measure, right? You pursue my people into the sea, it will be the sea that destroys you. That's the way it works. In Deuteronomy 32, the Lord saw this and rejected them because he was angered by his sons and daughters. I will hide my face from them, he said, and see what their end will be. For they are a perverse generation, children who are unfaithful. They made me jealous by what is no God and angered me with their worthless idols. I will make them envious by those who are not a people. I will make them angry by a nation that has no misunderstanding. So J.H. Hertz, who has a wonderful commentary on the Torah portions and the Haftorah portions, it's footnoted below, just as the people of Israel had angered God by adopting a no-God, so would God anger them by bringing against them a no people, a horde of barbarians. And, of course, this idea is emphasized in the Gospel of Matthew as well. Do not judge, or you too will be judged. In the same way you judge others, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Right? It's the exact same principle. So, moving on to number three. But even after a diagnosis of tzara'at had been made, the state of ritual impurity that pertains to the afflicted person or object did not take effect until a kohen pronounced it impure. By the same token, since it was the kohen's word that affected the state of tzara'at, the removal of this state, even after all physical signs of tzara'at had departed, was likewise achieved only by the Kohen's declaration that the Masorah had been cured of his impurity. There is a fascinating application of this principle in Matthew 8 and Luke 17. When Yeshua came down from the mountainside, large crowds followed him. By the way, this story is repeated in three of the four Gospels. There aren't that many stories that do appear in three of the four Gospels. It's even rarer for a story to appear in all four Gospels. But a man with leprosy came and knelt before him and said, "Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean." Yeshua reached out his hand and touched the man. "I am willing," he said. And notice what Yeshua says to him. "Be clean. Be healed. Be whole." Immediately he was cleansed of his leprosy. Right? So, what does Yeshua say in verse 4? Then Yeshua said to him, "See that you don't tell anyone." Why not? You would think, you know, for someone who had been cured of a devastating disease, you would think that is exactly what they would want to do. Tell people the good news, right? But Yeshua says, "Go, show yourself to the priest and offer the gift Moses commanded as a testimony to them." Why shouldn't he tell anyone? Because he wasn't clean until the priest said so. That's why. Right? So, here's a passage in which Yeshua is obviously following the Torah and obviously instructing people who he touches and heals to follow the Torah and its instructions as well, right? And there's no abrogating of these instructions. You know, the leper could be clean, but he's not clean until the Kohen says he's clean and he offers the gift that Moses commanded. And that is quite interesting, too. I'm not sure we'll have time to talk about any of those details, but in Luke 17, now, on his way to Jerusalem, Yeshua traveled along the border between Samaria and Galilee. As he was going into the village, 10 men who had leprosy met him. They stood at a distance and called out. Why did they stand at a distance? Because they're unclean, right? They had the sense not to approach anyone because contact with them would make them unclean, right? So they call out to Yeshua in a loud voice, "Yeshua, Master, have pity on us." When he saw them, he said, "Go, show yourselves to the priests." And as they went, they were cleansed. One of them, when he saw he was healed, came back, praising God in a loud voice. He threw himself at Yeshua's feet and thanked him. Notice in Luke's account here, it is noted that he was a Samaritan. And, you know, that would have that would have been a difficult thing to come to terms with, particularly because Yeshua says in verse 17, were not all 10 cleansed? Where are the other 9? Has no one returned to give praise to God except this foreigner? And that's one of the kind of subliminal themes that we see in the Gospels. The righteousness of non-Jews in comparison to the righteousness of the leadership of the Jewish community, right? The people of Nineveh will rise up in judgment against this generation. Why? Because they repented at the preaching of Jonah. But the people of the Galilee, and particularly in Jerusalem, don't repent at the preaching of Messiah. Now, obviously, many, many Jews did. Right? It's the leadership that Yeshua is referring to, and the leadership that the Gospels make a point of emphasizing, right? That the people embrace Yeshua as the Messiah for the most part. The ones who don't are the ones from out of town who don't know what's going on, and the religious leadership at the time, who frankly, in many cases, shouldn't have been in the position of being a religious leader because they were appointed by the Roman government and not, they did not ascend to their position, through their tribal inheritance, right? At any rate, then he said to him, rise and go, your faith has made you well. But this is after he came back. He was told, as in Matthew 8, go to the priest. You have to go to the priest, otherwise you're not clean, regardless of the way your skin looks, right? Also, from the tractate in the Talmud, and this is interesting, Rob said, the world was created for the sake of the Messiah. What is his, the Messiah's name? The school of Rabbi Shiloh said his name is Shiloh, for it is written, until Shiloh come. The word Shiloh means sent. It's from the prophecy of Jacob over Judah in Genesis 49. The rabbi said his name is the leper, the Metzora scholar, as it is written, surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we did esteem him a Metzora, a leper, smitten of God and afflicted. A quote from Isaiah 53. So this is one of the passages, one of many passages in the Talmud and in the rabbinic literature. Generally, all genres of rabbinic literature, everything from the Mishnah to the Talmud to the responsa to the mystical literature that emphasizes the role of the Messiah. The Messiah ben Joseph, one who suffers innocently on behalf of his people. That is something emphasized here. Number 4. This explains a rather puzzling statement in the Talmud, speaking ill of another ills 3 people, the speaker, the listener, and the one of whom they speak. The speaker obviously commits a grave sin by deriding their fellow. The listener, too, is a partner to this evil, but why is the worst one who is spoken of, why is the one who is spoken of penalized by their deed? Is their negative state worsened by the fact that it is spoken of? Indeed, such is the case. When this evil is spoken of, it is made that much more manifest and real. By defining a person's trait or deeds as evil to themselves and to others, the evil speakers are, in effect, solidifying it as such. With their words, they grant substance and reality to its negative form. So, there are many passages that speak of the power of words. So, we'll just talk about a few of them. From Proverbs, a gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. The tongue of the wise commends knowledge, but the mouth of the fool gushes folly. Right? when the mouth of the fool gushes folly, or the tongue of the wise commends knowledge, they are doing it with words, right? With language, with speech, with all of the qualities or attributes or characteristics that make up the way language works, right? So these are words. And of course, they come from the inner man. They come from the heart. In Proverbs 15, a man finds joy in giving an apt reply, and how good is a timely word, right? This is a statement which I appreciate when you have an opportunity to let someone know, a child, a grandchild, right? A son, a daughter, whatever it might be, a spouse, a friend. It's nice to let them know how much you appreciate them, or with a child, how proud you are of them. And it's nice when that comes to a child who is young enough to actually appreciate it, right? But this is an important statement. From Proverbs 18, a fool's mouth is his destruction, and his lips are the snare of his soul. This is a doublet. The mouth and the lips are the same thing, and the destruction and the snare of his soul is the same thing. It's just two different ways of saying the exact same thing, right? Because it's Hebrew. It likes to say things twice, sometimes three times, but almost always twice. The words of a talebearer are as wounds, and they go down into the innermost parts of the belly, right? So it's like what we said earlier about sticks and stones. But the words of a talebearer are just like wounds, and in some cases, they're deeper. In this case, they go down into the innermost parts of the belly, right? Into the innermost, that's my Callie's tail. At any rate, it reaches deep inside of us, harmful or hurtful words. In Proverbs 25, a word aptly spoken is like apples of gold in settings of silver, like an earring of gold or an ornament of fine gold is a wise man's rebuke to a listening ear, right? So a wise man's rebuke or correction can be regarded as a good thing, as something which is benevolent or beneficial. But it is like gold. Now, I mean, for most of us, it is hard to imagine things which are much more valuable than gold, right? I mean, of course, there are metals which are, but for practical purposes, we tend to prize gold more highly than other things. From Ecclesiastes, the teacher searched to find just the right words, and what he wrote was upright and true. And by the way, this is probably the challenge of every teacher, right? To find just the right words to communicate what it is that the teacher is trying to say. From Isaiah 50, the sovereign Lord has given me an instructed tongue to know the word that sustains the weary, right? So the instructed tongue is the word that sustains the weary. It's the language, it's the spoken language that sustains the weary, or the instructions that are provided to others to help sustain the weary. He wakens me morning by morning, wakens my ear to listen like one being taught. Also from James, not many of you should become teachers, my fellow believers, because you know that we who teach will be judged more strictly. We all stumble in many ways. Anyone who is never at fault in what they say is perfect, able to keep their whole body in check. when we put bits into the mouths of horses to make them obey us, we can turn the whole animal. Or take ships as an example. Although they are so large and are driven by strong winds, they are steered by a very small rudder wherever the pilot wants to go. Likewise, the tongue is a small part of the body, but it makes great boasts. Consider what a great forest is set on fire by a small spark. The tongue also is a fire, a world of evil among the parts of the body. It corrupts, or can corrupt, obviously, the whole body, sets the whole course of one's life on fire, and is itself set on fire by hell. All kinds of animals have been tamed by mankind, but no human can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil, full of deadly poison. And by the way, this is all an expression of hyperbole, right? I mean, it's very dramatic, exaggerated. With the tongue we praise our Lord and Father, and with it we curse human beings who have been made in God's likeness. Out of the same mouth come praise and cursing. My brothers and sisters, this should not be. Can both fresh water and salt water flow from the same spring? My brothers and sisters, can a fig tree bear olives or a grapevine bear figs? Neither can a salt spring produce fresh water. A very powerful, direct statement regarding the power of words. And lastly, number 5. With the few minutes we have left, I just want to read this. Everyone has experienced the power of words in one way or another. A kind word that soothes a broken heart, an authentic compliment that inspires confidence and motivates success, or a disparaging word that crushes the spirit, potentially leaving lifelong scars. Words can harm or heal, but not just because of the thoughts they trigger. Judaism teaches that a spoken word holds tremendous power. According to the Torah, the world itself was spoken into being by God, making reality a kind of cosmic prayer or poem composed of the divine word. In Hasidic thought, once a concept has been articulated verbally, it is drawn further down into existence, and thus can affect other people beyond the speaker, even at the other end of the world. When Rabbi Dov Ber, the Magid of Mezrich, the Rabbi Dov Ber was the disciple of the Baal Shem Tov. The Magid means a storyteller. He emphasized storytelling in his communication with others. When Rabbi Dov Ber would conceive of a new Torah concept, he would make a point of speaking it audibly, even if those present could not understand it. Why? Because speech gives sound to ideas and clothes them in subtle form and matter, which adds a physical dimension to the ethereal fruits of the mind. Thus, through verbalizing the idea, the Magid would draw it down into the world, which is precisely the objective of parables, right? That's what parables are for. And, of course, the Magid, right, because of his training and education, he was very familiar with rabbinic parables. And, you know, we are familiar with not only rabbinic parables, but the parables of Yeshua, right? And they are very, very similar, in some cases identical. Interestingly, the Hebrew word for speech, and this is a remarkable statement, please give it some thought. Interestingly, the Hebrew word for speech, dibur, is etymologically linked to the word devar, which means thing. That's because once articulated, a word takes on a life of its own and becomes a tangible reality, a thing that exists in dimension, form, and resonance. Right? This is one of what I regard to be one of the remarkable qualities of Hebrew, the connections that exist between words and the theological implications of those connections, right? And this statement is a very powerful one. That's because once articulated, a word takes on a life of its own and becomes a tangible reality, a thing that exists in dimension, form, and resonance. Okay, so I'm going to stop talking and see if there are any comments or questions about the about our study this afternoon. Anybody?
I thought about Aaron Love's sister Miriam.
Yes.
When she spoke, I guess she's speaking against Moses, and then she was struck with leprosy. Is that is it the same thing? Is it the same concept, or is it different?
It is the same concept. She was guilty of lashon hara, evil speech, right? She spoke against Moses and against his authority, right? And I mean, she should have been among, you know, the people who recognized that God had raised up Moses to deliver them. She was actually a participant in the deliverance process. In fact, the rabbis referred to her as a prophetess and as a Messiah, right, because of her role in delivering the people from Egypt. But we don't know why, not to my knowledge. I don't know that we know why. And then, of course, she kind of persuaded Aaron to participate with her, which is apparent from the fact that Aaron is not punished, but Miriam is. So Miriam is the one who kind of spearheaded that charge or accusation against Moses. But that is why she was smitten with Tzara'at, was because of her evil speech. Yep. Good one. Thanks, Ed. Good connection. Anybody else before we go? By the way, we don't know. Based upon what we read today, you would get the impression that all Tzara'at was a condition that exists because of evil speech, slander, testifying falsely, those kinds of things. But in the scriptures, individuals with leprosy or Tzara'at aren't always identified that way. Not like that's what I appreciate about what Ed just brought up about Miriam, right? I mean, she speaks evil against Moses, and she's smitten with leprosy, right? So the connection between them is very straightforward. But with the lepers mentioned in the Gospels, for example, or Naaman, the leper who comes to Elisha and is told to dip 7 times in the Jordan River, we don't know anything about their lives or what they were guilty of doing or saying, right? We just assume, based upon the teaching from the Torah, that Tzara'at is related to evil speech. This kind of skin disease is related to evil speech. Good. Very good. Anybody else before we go?
Yes, Rabbi. We seem to have a dilemma here in from this perspective. So there are things that are happening, people doing things, and they're not right. And so, I mean, it seems like we're kind of caught here in that if we speak against this and criticize it, it seems to me, based on what we're studying, that that would be considered evil speech, that we're actually in power. So where do you find balance?
Yeah, that's a great question. In Jewish thought, there is a difference between something that is said or done privately and something that is said or done publicly, right? So a dear friend of mine wrote me a few weeks ago and asked me about a passage in the book of Romans that said we should obey our governing authorities because they are all put into their position by God, right? So what do you do when the governing authority is corrupt? So one of the things that I mentioned to them is that Paul goes on in that passage to say that governing authorities are not a threat to the law-abiding, but to the lawbreaker, right? So it kind of helps us define the governing authorities that we should support and sustain as authorities that uphold law, uphold the rule of law, and protect the rights of citizens. That's something that the government has a responsibility to do. When that aspect of their authority is compromised, when the Constitution or the laws of a nation are violated and the people of a community are enslaved or arrested without due process and charged and many other things, then we have a responsibility to rise up against it and to say something about what is going on and to try to hold those people accountable for whatever it is, for what it is that they are doing, right? So when there are public statements made that violate the very principles upon which the nation was built or established, then we have a responsibility to say something about it and to do something. And the reason why it doesn't fall into this category is because it's all a part of, you know, what we would regard as a public debate, right? So these are things which are done publicly and expressed publicly. The issues that we are kind of talking about this afternoon, and I think the issues that the Rebbe brings up in this essay, has to do with interpersonal relations, right? Has to do with people that we are connected to, you know, a friend, a neighbor, you know, a shop owner, right? I mean, there are a good deal, a lot of considerations with regard to people that we relate to. In other words, you know, let's say I walk into a shop on Main Street and I find something that I'm looking for, right? I don't know how much it should cost, so I take out my phone and I look up the item on Amazon, right? So I find that on Amazon, I can buy it for less. So I leave the shop and I buy it for less on Amazon and I have it sent to my house, right? So I found what I was looking for. It costs less at Amazon than it did in the shopkeeper's store. So that's what I did, right? Now, whether or not that is a good thing, that's another matter. But it would be wrong of me at that point to tell my friends and neighbors that if you ever need something, don't shop at this guy's shop down the street because his prices are higher than they are on Amazon, right? that would be an example of what we're talking about, right? We would be saying something that impugns the integrity of a local shopkeeper. I mean, the fact of the matter is that we don't know, how much his shop costs, how much it costs to rent the space, how much his electricity costs or his gas costs, or, you know, how much all of the stuff in his shop costs to display products, you know, pleasingly. Do you understand what I'm saying? I mean, we just aren't privy to that kind of information. We assume that because of Amazon's reach, you know, that they have the ability to get things for less than other places do, right? So brick and mortar stores tend to be, and have been for the last decade, have been penalized by online retailers that don't have any of the expenses that a brick and mortar shop does. So there's a lot that goes into these kinds of things. And that's, I think, the kind of thing that we're talking about, not objecting to an unlawful act, you know, by someone in a position of power, someone who has done something illegally and needs to be held accountable for it. Right? And, of course, the best solution, particularly with regard to politics, is, you know, our vote. Right? We can make sure that they are not reelected, or that people who support them are reelected. Right? I mean, unfortunately, democracy, even one such as in our republic, is a very cumbersome mechanism, and things tend not to take place very quickly. So we just have to, that's why education is so important. It's important that the people in a community are educated, that they understand what the issues are and what's at stake, right? Because they have to make wise decisions. And, education in the United States has gotten very dismal. I mean, we trail many of the other countries in the world in our educational prowess, I could say. Very sad to see that. At any rate, David, did that, you have a follow-up, or was that?
Thank you, Rabbi. That helped from that perspective. And also, you said something that I think is critical and very important here, is speaking out against something and doing something about it.
Yeah.
Complaining, to me, seems to be actually a form of slander, because when you complain, you're really not doing anything about it. You're probably making the situation worse.
Yeah, I agree. When you just complain about something, you make the situation worse because those complaints affect the people that you are connected to, right? So they grow despondent too, right? They begin to imagine, boy, things are so bad, there's nothing anybody can do about it, and we might as well roll over and play dead. But that, of course, is not what we're called to do. We have to do whatever it is that we can to affect change, for the good. And it's not always the same thing, right? I mean, for some of us, that might be to fly to Washington and participate in a rally, or, right, it might be getting involved in local politics or state politics or whatever. I mean, there's lots of ways to have an impact in the lives of others with regard to issues like this. Yeah. I agree. I appreciate you bringing that up. So, good. Thank you, David. Anybody else before we go? I see there's a couple of Shabbat Shalom from Shecky, from Shelley, from Rivka. Shabbat Shalom, everyone, using a different tablet that has my name spelled wrong. Thank you, Rivka, from Beth Ann. Shabbat Shalom, everyone. From Susanna, Shabbat Shalom, everyone. So also, would Yeshua have become ritually impure by touching the leper and then have to purify himself? This is something that has come up on occasion before. This is one of the remarkable things, is that Yeshua does not become unclean as a result of his contact with the leper. And the only other example of this that we find in the Bible is the altar upon which the sacrifices are offered. When a dead animal, which is unclean technically, is placed upon the brazen altar in the courtyard of the temple, the altar transfers its holiness to the sacrifice. The sacrifice does not transfer its impurity to the altar, right? And that is true in the case of Yeshua as well, which would obviously be another among many indications that he's not human like us, that he has a flesh and blood. He is a flesh and blood person, but he's a manifestation of God in a physical form. You know, he's not just like, he's not a person like we are. He wasn't birthed like we are. His life is different than ours, but it's because of who he is. So, it's because of his intrinsic holiness that he can transfer that holiness to someone he touches, as opposed to having their impurity transferred to him. It's an interesting phenomenon. So, thank you, Suzanne. I hope that helps. From Beth Ann, just a comment. In reading a commentary earlier, I found it fascinating that evidence of tzara'atz first started in the home, then affected the clothing, then the skin, and that the first two were warnings from God. I had not realized that concerning the progression of tzara'at. Yeah, tzara'at is a progressive disease, right? It starts in one spot, but then spreads over the skin, which is, you know, interesting too. By the way, the commentary that Beth Ann is referring to is a commentary she read at Chabad.org, and I'll be sending that to you after our study, right? Because it was it has some good things to say about the same subject that we just discussed. Okay, so I'll send that to you when we're concluded. And if you're interested, you can read that as well. Good. Thank you, Beth Ann, Susanna. Anybody else before we go? And Rivka, thanks for letting us know that you're Shelley and not Shecky. Anyone else before we go?
Rabbi, a couple more things. The first one is, when a person has to be removed from the community and isolated, who supports their family that stayed behind? And how would that have been done?
That's a great question, too. Sadly, to my knowledge, the scripture does not address that issue either. I think it's because other members of the extended family are expected to pick up that role. It's like in the parable of the man with the despicable friend, right? A man has someone come to visit him at night, and he doesn't have anything to give him, to feed him, no bread, right, which can imply other things as well, right, other things of substance as well. So he goes to his neighbor, he knocks on the door, right, or he calls out to him, and he says, hey, you know, a traveler just came to visit me. I'm out of bread. Can you give me some? And the neighbor says, no, absolutely not. I'm already in bed. My family's in bed. Everybody's settled in, right? I just, you know, and then when he asks again, and besides, I don't have any bread, right? So I don't have anything to give you. I'm not in a position to give you anything, and I don't have anything to give you. So the guy is insistent, and that's what the parable is about. It's about insistent prayer, praying with chutzpah, right? In other words, pressing. This man presses his neighbor to the point that he realizes that if I don't get up and give you some bread, I'm not going to enjoy a moment's sleep tonight, right? So that's what he does. But what is behind the parable that is rarely discussed has to do with the responsibility of members of a community or members of a neighborhood to take care of each other, right? So, if something like this were to happen, then and think about it. I mean, the guy is put out of the camp because of his divisive speech, right? So. The fact that members of the community are expected to stand up and, you know, and help support the family of the one affected is just a remarkable thing, because it's possible that he has hurt some of them in the process, right? So they're supposed to put that aside and take care of matters. But it would have fallen to relatives who, in biblical times, they tended to live close to each other. I mean, you know, today I live in Minnesota. I happen to live a few blocks away from my daughter. You know, I live close enough so that my grandson can ride his bicycle over to my house by himself, right? But my son and my other two grandchildren live in Los Angeles, so they're far away. And Shelley's family lives in California and Nevada, so they're very far away too, right? So it places an inordinate amount of stress or difficulty. It imposes difficulty upon a relationship in ways that really didn't exist in biblical times. You know, I mean, for the most part, people didn't really live far from home. They lived together in communities. I mean, fathers, sons, brothers, uncles, they worked together in the same trade. And, you know, children would have been raised by mothers and grandmothers and aunts and cousins and older cousins, you know, people related to each other. That's one of the things that makes this issue so compelling, right? I mean, you know, we have difficulty with a friend, and then for whatever reason, we move away and we never see them again. So it's not like there's any pressing reason to restore a relationship that we have no interest or ability to preserve, right? But in biblical times, it was essential that these issues were resolved, because you saw these people every day, right? You know, one of the benefits of living in a big town or in a city is, you know, the anonymity that exists. You know, I mean, you're anonymous. Nobody knows you, and you don't know anybody. One of the things that's characteristic of a small town is that people do tend to know each other, right? But, I mean, Waconia is a small town in Minnesota, but it still has over 10,000 people. You know, I mean, in biblical times, we weren't talking about thousands of people. We were talking about hundreds of people, right? I mean, a city like Jerusalem, which was the largest city in Israel in the first century, some people imagine that it had about 30,000 permanent residents, right? I mean, if a town in the United States has 30,000 permanent residents, you're probably going to get a Costco, right? Or an Outback Steakhouse or a Trader Joe's, something that we in Waconia don't have, but neighboring towns that are that big, they do, right? So we miss a lot of these issues. These issues aren't as relevant for us because of our living circumstances that they were in biblical times. They were a big, big deal in biblical times and made or broke a community, right? Yeah. Okay, thanks, David. There's another...
Rabbi, there was something else.
Yeah, go ahead.
While you were speaking, I thought about this, that if you now throw the aspect of social media into the mix or that, picture, this probably tremendously amplifies the damage that can be done by somebody posting something about somebody else.
I agree. I agree. Right, so that means that we have to be careful about the things that we post, right? Yep, I agree. That's a big problem because, you know, I mean, resolving issues, in person is always better than, you know, doing it over a text or over a phone or even on Zoom, you know. But I, for example, some of the treatment that I have done at the VA in Minneapolis has been on Zoom, right? And, you know, it's treatment for something that, you know, is thought not to require a personal visit, right? So, and it saves me a 45-minute drive in one direction, right? So there are some blessings associated with it, and our ability to do this, for example. You know, that's why it's so nice to see people's faces, you know, when we interact with each other. There's a huge difference, you know, when you can see someone's expressions when you're talking to them. You know, I mean, I don't do so much anymore, but I have done a good deal of public speaking. And, you know, and for me, seeing the faces of the people in the audience has a lot to do with what I say or how I say it, right? I mean, I could say the exact same thing with two different audiences and it wouldn't come out the same, right? Just depends on the audience. And I know that's true of others, too. But, social media has made things a lot more complicated. Yeah, absolutely. By the way, on my Facebook page, I delete humiliating... You know, like if someone posts a cartoon about someone that the objective is to humiliate, I delete it, right? But I post things that have to do with, if we're talking about political things, I post things that, in which a egregious violation of a constitutional law is done, right? So it's one of the things I was talking about earlier, that we have to make some kind of, we have to respond publicly in some way to egregious public political behavior. Yeah. Right. But, don't make fun of somebody because it's going to be deleted. If you want to state a truth, that supports or, opposes someone, fine. I don't delete those. But I do delete things that are intended to belittle or shame or humiliate. And by the way, there are platforms that that tend to check things like that, and others that don't, unfortunately. There are platforms which, all kinds of evil, wicked, nasty things are said about people who oppose their perspective or their view, right? And when that happens on Facebook, people, for example, who are at a rally, a demonstration, right, and they're holding a sign that says something against, the position of, it doesn't matter who it is, but, it can be any political, anyone in office, right? And I've had people, that has been posted, it was posted onto my page. I didn't post it, but someone responded on my page, those people are a bunch of morons or idiots or they're stupid, right? So I deleted it. I deleted the comment, right? Just because someone has a different political view than you doesn't mean they're morons or evil. But that's the way things have gotten. It's really tragic, right? That people can't disagree with each other and still be regarded as good, decent people, right? Everybody's evil. They're of the devil. They're involved in witchcraft and sorcery and all kinds of other things, right? God forbid anybody should have a thought, a rational, reasonable thought that is different from mine, right? Because, of course, I'm always right. My views are the right ones, right? Well, anyone who thinks that is a moron. At any rate, yeah. So, David, thank you. Let's see, there is a comment from Elmer. Impure is not sin, I heard. It is not accepting the condition of impurity that makes sin. Talking about impurity because of our ego that denies it. That's correct. Impurity is not necessarily sin, but impurity may be caused by sin, but it itself is, being impure. Impurity can be for a lot of reasons. If, for example, a friend of yours passes away and you are involved in the burial of that individual, or, for example, treating and preparing their body for burial, you become impure by the contact with the dead body. But you are doing a benevolent thing, right? In other words, in Jewish thought, you would be regarded as doing something above and beyond the call of duty because you're doing something for someone who can't return the favor they're dead, right? So a person who does do that would be regarded as impure and would have to go through a mikvah, and they would be impure. You know, it depends on what it is. That determines how long the period of impurity lasts. But the point is that impurity itself is not necessarily sin. It's what gets us there that's the sin. And like Elmer says, you know, the ego that denies the reason why we're like this, right? And that's something that obviously needs to be looked at too, or maybe not so obviously, as Elmer elegantly puts it. From Susanna, another comment: we as believers are not required to follow the government if their rule is a contradiction to God's law. And by the way, that's true for servicemen as well. I mean, soldiers are not required to obey immoral orders, right? There have been obviously a lot of movies about this, but if in combat, the members of a platoon are told to destroy an innocent village of people and slaughter the men, the women, and the children, and the animals too, I mean, it may be done, but it's not a law which a soldier has an obligation to follow. I mean, they're going to pay a price for not following it, but that's the way it's supposed to work, right? And this is true. We aren't required to follow immoral laws. It's tragic that before equal rights, so many people observed the immoral laws associated with, you know, with segregation, a stain on this nation. For example, when the Israelites were in Babylonian exile and commanded to bow down to the image and question, right? So yeah, right, that's right. You don't, even if you're commanded to bow down to an image, you don't, because it's idolatry. When the leper went through the purification process after being designated as clean, would the required sin offering be for forgiveness because of the sin of evil speech? Yeah, they would have to offer an offering to compensate, or as a part of the, what it would be required as the restoration process. Yes. Good. Susanna, thank you. From Charlene, thank you. Have a good evening. So I guess, yes, Charlene had to leave. Okay, very good. Good comments, questions, discussion. Anybody else before we go? Anyone?
Rabbi, one last thing. The analogy of a spark setting a forest on fire is so on point.
Yeah.
As we think about the recent wildfires in L.A., and I wrote myself a note that the great fire of Chicago, actually, that ended up burning, destroying the entire city. That's history.
Oh, I agree. Yeah, I agree. It's one of the things that you tend not to be too concerned about when you live in a city like Chicago or like Los Angeles, right? Unless you happen to live in a part of it that that is burnable. Like with the Los Angeles fires, the forested area north of Santa Monica and West Los Angeles, right? And then you see, or if you live, like when we lived in Lake Tahoe, you know, when you live in a forested area, or Yosemite or places like that, you know, where forest fires are not uncommon, and that is sadly the devastating fire that took place in Lake Tahoe a few years ago, the one that we had to be evacuated for, was started by a single spark from an electrical line I forget the name of the electrical utility, but it was from one of their substations, right? There was a spark on one of their substations, and they probably had not either. They were sued, by the way, for billions of dollars, but either they didn't follow the regulation that requires a specific distance between a structure and burnable brush, or they didn't maintain their equipment properly, right? They just didn't bother to make sure that something like that would not take place. So, I mean, no matter how careful you are, though, I mean, you've probably heard of dry lightning when there's lightning strikes without rain. And of course, you know, oftentimes when a fire is an arson fire, it started just with one match. Yeah, it's, you would think that would prompt us to be more careful. When I was involved in a business club in Palo Alto in the Bay Area, when I was living in the Bay Area, each person in the group was required to give it a little talk about what it is that they did, right? So I'm an electrical contractor, so I spoke a little bit on one occasion about the benefit of LED light bulbs over conventional light bulbs, right? And another time I spoke about knob and tube wiring, which is something that a lot of the homes in the Bay Area were built using, knob and tube wiring. It's safe, unless, of course, the insulation on the wire frays. But I showed a series of pictures of some dangerous situations in which knob and tube wiring was deployed. And, you know, the wire, it's an insulated wire, and it's stretched or held in place by a nail, right? And the nail is wrapped with an insulation so that the wire, the way it's wrapped around the nail, the metal of the nail never actually comes in contact with the wire itself, right? So it's usually safe. And there's usually an insulator around it, too, so that the wire can never come in contact with the metal part of the nail. So I showed a picture of someone's garage, and I referred to it as my personal favorite of the dozen or so pictures that I used of very dangerous conditions. Someone, their basement or shed or this room of their home, garage, was wired. It was all knob and tube wiring. And they had put hubcaps. They hung hubcaps on the insulated nails that held the knob and tube wiring in place. Dozens of hubcaps, metal hubcaps, are hanging on the wall and supported by the nails, the metal nails that hold up the knob and tube wiring, right? And if there was ever going to be a spark that set a building on fire, that would have been one of the places where it would take place. You know, just, you know, you think to yourself, you know, I can't imagine anyone doing that, but it made a good point in my comment about the safety of knob and tube wiring, what we do with it. But, yeah, it is remarkable. And that's the same point that James makes, you know, that a spark can start a huge fire. A ship can be directed by a small rudder. Yeah. Yeah. Things that result in massive consequences can start with a tiny infraction. Yeah. Very sad, but true. Very good. Very good. Thank you, David. Rivka mentions the Nuremberg trials. That's in connection with my comment about, you know, soldiers who were arrested and tried at Nuremberg saying, oh, we were only following orders. Right? That is a defense that no longer works. Right? It may have worked at some point in history, but it certainly is not a rational defense or a reasonable defense today. That will not get someone acquitted from committing a crime. Right? I was just doing what I was told. Well, what you were told to do was wrong. Right? And because you did what you were told, you are just as guilty as the person who ordered you to do it. So from Susanna, last question, how would we purify ourselves today, for example, if we become unclean for some reason, like touching a deceased pet, etc.? Does this apply to us Torah-observing believers today who may not have access to a mikvah? How should we observe? So, yeah, that's a good question, too. In the Orthodox Jewish community, the practice of bathing in a mikvah is routine, right? So people, for example, would bathe in a mikvah before Shabbat or bathe in a mikvah before Shavuot, a holiday, or Passover, or Rosh Hashanah, or Yom Kippur, right? So that they would be in a purified state or a clean state when they gathered together to worship the Lord. But in biblical times, the issue of uncleanness was primarily only relevant for those who were going to go to the tabernacle or to the temple to participate in a service, right? In other words, in Orthodox Judaism, and probably in some conservative circles too, depends on a person's access to a mikvah, which could be a mikvah or a lake or a stream, a river, the ocean, a body of water where it's possible to immerse oneself. But for the most part, the condition of impurity is not very relevant for us today. Because we're not going to participate in a service at a place that requires that we are ritually pure, right? So, if there was a temple and we wanted to go to the temple, then we would have to go through the waters of a mikvah on the way up the steps into the temple courtyard. But because there is no temple, it's a relatively moot point these days, although it is taken seriously by some people in the community. You would have to either go to a body of water, which, by the way, I think is a good thing to do generally. I think it helps to appreciate the significance of impurity and how it affects our relationships with others, right? So it's a good practice or a good thing to practice. But for the most part, it doesn't have, it doesn't make a lot of difference. I hate to put it like that, but, you know, because there's, you know, but for example, in an Orthodox community where, you know, a woman menstruates and she's unclean because of the menstruation, she would go through a mikvah before she and her husband would resume normal conjugal relations, right? So in some communities it is regarded as an important issue, but and that is something that would have been done biblically too. So what I just described is something that would have been done in biblical times, regardless of whether or not someone was going to go to the tabernacle or the temple, right? This is something, or if you touch the animal, the body of a dead animal or the body of a dead person, you're unclean, right? So if you don't want to transfer that impurity to others, you should go through the waters of a mikvah. Now, they won't appreciate what it is you've done or why, but, you know. But in some cases, it's a part of the way Jewish life works. So it's done because it's a part of the way Jewish life works. And in other cases, it's not. Right? So I hope that answer was okay. I realize that a good deal more could be said about it. But thank you, Susanna.
But if they do go into a mikvah, though, with some uncleanness, then wouldn't the mikvah have to be, wouldn't it have to be drained out or something like that to make sure that... You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean. And that would be true if a mikveh was filled with stagnant water. But it's not. Mikvehs have to have living water in order to be a mikveh. In other words, you could not, like the Dead Sea in Israel, even though it's a large body of water, would not be regarded as a mikvah because the water is not flowing. Water flows into the Dead Sea, but it doesn't flow out. So the Sea of Galilee could be used as a mikvah because the water flows in and the water flows out, right? Which is the way mikvahs are designed. Water always comes in and always goes out. It's not a stagnant, stationary body of water, right? Like in most pools, for example. If a pool was designed so that water, fresh water comes in as some of the water is removed, then it would qualify as a mikvah. But a pool generally would not qualify because the water is stationary. I mean, it moves around in the pool, but no fresh water is introduced to it, into it, unless the water level is low, right? But if you designed a pool so that water came in and water went out, not only would you have a high water bill, but that would work. But that's the benefit that oceans and rivers provide, and lakes. Right, so that's why the water itself is not rendered impure, because it's not the same water. Right, the water that comes in contact with you as someone who does a mikvah, you know, by the time the next person gets in there, that water is gone. Yeah.
So, Rabbi, so the Jewish communities, then they use like maybe a local lake or stream?
They can. But typically, if a community has the ability, they build a mikveh because a mikveh is more private. And today, this was not true in biblical times because mikvehs were... they weren't all public, but for the most part, they were done publicly. Like when people immerse themselves in the Jordan River, I mean, you know, you do all the same things, but you don't remove all of your clothes. Right? So, but in a mikvah today, that's what you do do. You remove your clothes so that the water touches every part of your body. And even your hair has to go underwater too. So, if you have long hair, you know, the hair, when you go underwater, the hair floats up. Right? So there is an attendant who makes sure that your hair is underwater too. You know, so it would be a male attendant for a man who goes to a mikveh and a female attendant for a woman. And oftentimes it's, you know, it's someone that the person knows, but not always. But that's what the role of the attendant is. Like John the Baptist was the attendant at baptisms. He did not baptize anyone. That's not the way baptism was done in biblical times. Right? So, baptism is the way it is today because of the teaching of the church fathers, not the Bible. And the Catholic Church baptizes infants because of their understanding of original sin, which is not biblical. And the Baptist Church baptizes adults because of their understanding of the way things are supposed to work. Right? But baptizing or being immersed in a mikvah doesn't require an officiant. Right? Doesn't require a pastor or a priest or a rabbi. Those are all based upon the teachings of the church fathers and their understanding of the way authority works. So, good. Thank you, David. Anyone else before we go?
Rabbi?
Yeah.
You may have already said, but at Jewish congregations, are there mikvahs?
It depends on the size of the congregation and where they're located. What typically happens is that a number of congregations will get together and create or build a mikvah for the use of the Jewish members of the community, right, of the Jewish community that's represented by those organizations. So that's what typically happens is that, well, in places like New York where there is a big Jewish population, then there would be several mikvahot that a person could go to. But in other areas, communities get together and will contribute to the building of a mikvah at one of the participating synagogues. Right? So the one synagogue takes responsibility for, you know, maintaining the mikvah and taking, you know, making sure that it's, you know, that people have access to it and people can make appointments. And, you know, so one of the synagogue staff, you know, part of their job would be making sure that the mikvah is fit for anyone in the community who wants to use it. And that synagogue takes the responsibility for doing that. Right, so that's typically the way it works. So the best thing to do if you are interested in a mikvah is to check online, or you can check with the rabbi in your community. They may, you know, if anyone knows where there is a community mikvah, it would be the rabbi, if there is one around.
Okay, yeah, there's some pretty sizable synagogue in Houston, so there might be one there.
Oh, I'm certain that there is a mikvah in Houston somewhere. I can't imagine that there is not a mikvah in Houston somewhere. Yeah. Thank you, Beth Ann. Good question, comments. Anybody else before we go? Next week we have from Rivka. She said, I was mikvahed in Berkeley. And what happened there, the same thing. The mikvah is associated with a synagogue in Berkeley and other, and what happens is when synagogues in the community need the use of a mikvah, they arrange to use this particular synagogue in Berkeley and use their mikvah. That's the way it works, right? So the community tries to facilitate the needs. The synagogue with a mikvah tries to facilitate the needs of other synagogues who don't have a mikvah, but have people who need to be mikvahed. Right, that's what they do. So, that's a question I can't answer, unfortunately. From Susanna, probably can't use the mikvah if not Jewish. That's a good question. If that, I'm not sure. My initial response would be to say probably not, but you know, it's possible that if the staff or the rabbi of a synagogue know how important somebody, you know, how important the process of being mikvahed was to somebody, they might regard you as a righteous Gentile if you're not Jewish and permit it. So I'm not sure. There are probably some who do and some that don't. But, you know, if that is an issue, then the easiest thing to do is to mikvah in a lake or a river, right? If you don't live near the ocean. So, very good. From Susanna, could you vouch for us? Yeah, no, I'm afraid not. As much as I would love to, I'm afraid not. I was one time asked to be a member of a Beit Din, and I was very honored to be asked. But I did not do it. I did not participate in the Beit Din. There was somebody in the community that wanted to convert to Judaism, and they needed a Beit Din to ratify the conversion. So there was a rabbi in the community who knew me and asked me to participate in the Beit Din. I was very honored but decided against doing it. So I'm afraid I cannot vouch for you. Sorry. Anybody else before we go? Anyone? Okay. Well, good discussion. And I appreciate the comments and the questions. All good things to talk about. So we have a double portion next Shabbat as well. And we're getting into the middle of the book of Leviticus. Chapter 19 is a very meaningful passage in the entire Torah. Very good. God bless you guys. Be well. Yes, Ed, go ahead.
No, I was just thanking you. Oh. For a great evening.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Ed. Always happy to see you and to interact like this. It's just a wonderful, wonderful blessing. So. Always good to see the faces.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you. Bye for now.
Bye. Nice to see you all.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Amen. Shabbat shalom. Thank you. God bless. Bye for now.